Okay, you'll have a sheet and you'll see the outline of what we're thinking about this evening. 1 Samuel 21 and 22. Listen to these wonderful words as I begin this evening. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. Well, listen to these words. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of the Lord. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise you forever because you have done it. And in the presence of your saints, I will wait on your name, for it is good. Psalms of praise. We think whatever wonderful circumstances led to those words. Where was the psalmist when he wrote those words? Was he on some idyllic psalm writing holiday in some wonderful place? Was it response to some particular blessing or some particular joy that he would write those words? Well, the truth is that those two psalms that I've just read from were both written in the midst of and in response to the events of these two chapters that we read from tonight. Psalm 34, Psalm 52, we'll come back to them later on. They're psalms that, in other words, come out of the midst of trouble and mess and disaster and sorrow and heartache and fear. They were terrible events, but they were events actually that led David to cast himself on the Lord and find his help from the Lord and find his joy in the Lord. And in the midst of the trouble and the trials, he knew God's help. He knew God's presence. He knew God's peace. He knew God's deliverance. So wonderful psalms, beautiful psalms. Praise comes out of trial. That's often the case, isn't it? That God often uses troubles and trials and difficulties to drive us to him and to find our joy in him when every other joy has dried up. And out of ashes and out of mess, the Lord brings something beautiful. Some of you are going through real trials at the moment. Some of you have gone through them. All of us will go through them. There's a happy thought for you. And yet the Lord is able, isn't he, in those to bring something beautiful, to bring praise, to bring us to taste and see that the Lord is good in all those things. So we come to these chapters then. We saw last time from chapter 20 that David now knows for sure that Saul wants him dead. Even Jonathan has had to admit it, hasn't he? And he sends his great friend David away. Do you remember that? And now David starts really a long period as a fugitive on the run from the jealous king Saul. So I want us to imagine how it must have felt for David. The tears are still running down his cheeks from that parting with Jonathan. You know, they wept, hadn't they, as they parted. We saw that at the end of the chapter. As Jonathan heads back into the city, David heads off into an uncertain future. Where can he go? Who can he trust? He can't pick up the Bible and read the rest of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. It makes clear that it work out all right in the end. He's having to leave the only person he has any confidence in, Jonathan. Where will he be safe? Who can he turn to? He's got no food. He's got no sword. He's alone. What's going to happen? We can imagine how he must have felt. The loneliness, the fear. Questions whirling around his head. Where is the Lord in all of this? Well, this evening we come to consider then these two chapters that really the beginning of David's period on the run. It's two chapters full of lies, full of deception, full of tension, full of sin, bloodshed. And yet once again, David comes out the other end, still intact, still alive, still protected, still provided for, still praising the Lord. So we've got four things, look, to think about this evening. Let's look at verses 1 to 9 of chapter 21. Pretending and provision. That's the first heading. Pretending and provision. So having left Jonathan, the first place David goes to is this place called Nob, or Nov would be either, it would be said in Hebrew. It sounds a bit better, doesn't it, than Nob? It's clearly the place where the tabernacle is now situated. When he arrives, he meets Ahimelech, the priest. Ahimelech's nervous when he sees that David's alone, we're told. That would be very unusual for someone of David's rank. He's the commander of the army. He's the king's son-in-law. For him to be alone. So he asks, why are you alone and no one's with you? Verse 1. And so in response, we have David pretending he's on some highly secret mission for the king. His men are hiding out in the countryside somewhere. David's just after some bread, some loaves, some food for him and his men. A little later on, of course, David also in verse 8 adds the pretense that he's had to leave so quickly he's forgotten his sword or his spear. He hasn't got anything, and is there something there that he could take? Well, the passage itself doesn't make any judgment, does it, on the rights or wrongs of what David does here, making up a story like he has. It may be, as some of the commentators suggest, he does it to try and keep Ahimelech out of any trouble. He knows, of course, from Jonathan that anyone who sides with him or attempts to help him or protect him is going to be in trouble with Saul. So perhaps David makes up this story to sort of try and protect Ahimelech and keep him from being implicated in helping the enemy of Saul. Well, we're not sure about that, and as we see at the end of the passage, it certainly doesn't help Ahimelech, does it? Jesus refers to this passage, doesn't he? You remember when Jesus' disciples are going through the fields of corn on the Sabbath and they pick some corn, don't they, and rub it together, and the priests and the Pharisees complain that they're breaking the Sabbath. Jesus refers to this story about, particularly about David eating the showbread. He makes no comment or judgment on the story that David makes up that leads to it. I mean, it's messy, isn't it? It's probably not right. But it's a difficult situation, isn't it? What do you do in a situation? He's on the run. People are after his life. Things aren't always black and white. I think the encouraging truth that we need to take away from this passage is, in spite of the mess and in spite of far from ideal circumstances, and despite the fact that David makes up this story, whatever you think of that, God still provides for him. God still watches over him. God still meets his needs. So David asks for some bread. There's no ordinary bread available. But there is the consecrated bread that's just been taken out of the tabernacle. So you may or may not know that Leviticus 24 tells us about it. The showbread. So in the tabernacle, in the holy place, you've got the holy place and then the holy of holies. So in the holy place, on one side was a table, a golden table, on which were placed 12 loaves of bread. 12 cakes of bread, 12 for the 12 tribes. It's called the showbread, or the bread of his presence, the bread of the presence. And it was a reminder to the people of the Lord's presence with them and provision for them, that God was the God who kept them and helped them and looked after them. And it was there in the sanctuary, in the tabernacle. Of course, when they'd been in the wilderness, they'd seen that in an amazing way, hadn't they? Every day, 6 days a week, the manna was provided for them. But it was still true, however the people got their food, it was the Lord who ultimately was with them and provided it for them. That was the showbread. That was what it was supposed to show, the bread of the present, the Lord with them. And every week, it would be renewed. So every week, new bread would be made, and the old bread would be taken away. And the priests alone were supposed to eat it. That was the rule. However, in this instance, then Ahimelech the priest is happy so long as David and his men are ritually pure for David to take some of the bread. So Ahimelech actually saw what the Pharisees failed to see, you know, all those years later, that although ceremony is important, mercy is more important, and there are some things that can be put aside for the sake of God's people. There it was, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. It was, you know, in that circumstance, mercy and grace and God's providing for his people was more important. So here's David, and so he has this bread. He's given this bread. And it was a reminder to him then. I mean, it was significant that it was this bread, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't by accident, was it? That Ahimelech just said, oh, my wife just made 5 loaves. Here's some for you. No, this is significant that actually that he's given this bread that reminded him of the presence of the Lord and the provision of the Lord. So we don't know where David sat and ate this bread, but you can imagine him on his own after he's left. And he's got this, and he sat down, and he's on his own, and he's eating this bread. But what is this bread? It's the bread that's been in the tabernacle. That's a reminder of the Lord's presence and provision and care and protection. And as he eats it, he's reminded that this is the God who's going to look after him and care for him and be with him. And of course, that's still true, isn't it? God still provides our daily bread for us. And gives us not just his provision, but he gives us his presence as well. And ultimately, this bread, of course, finds its fulfillment in Jesus, the bread of life, who's God's ultimate provision for us, providing us with all that we need for our souls as well as for our bodies. So it's little wonder David would write in one of the Psalms connected with this whole incident, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. I've tasted it literally, and I've tasted it spiritually. The Lord is good. And of course, David leaves not just with a bread, but with a sword as well, doesn't he? And not just any sword. We don't know whether David was aware of this when he arrived, but the sword of Goliath was at the tabernacle. Perhaps it was kept there as a reminder, wasn't it, of God's help for his people, the way he'd delivered his people in the past. And David gets his sword. Surely that was a double blessing for David. I mean, he needed a good sword. He's going to need a good sword. Well, Goliath's sword was a good sword, he says, doesn't he? There's none like it. I'll have that one. That's a good one. That's top of the range. But also, surely, it's also just a reminder to him of God's help in the past, wasn't it? As he picked it up and held it in his hands. I mean, it was with Goliath's own sword that he cut off his head, hadn't he? And it was just a reminder to David of God's help in the past. And so the Lord who's helped him so far will help him in the days to come in difficult circumstances. So he's got the bread that reminds him of the Lord's presence. And he's got this sword that reminds him of the Lord has been with him in the past and will be with him in the future as well. Pretending and provision. The Lord provides for us in all the mess of our lives, in all the things in our lives that are difficult and not always black and white. And the Lord, even in those things where in our lives that are black and where we sin and fail, the Lord still provides for us. His presence, his provision. We should be thankful for that this evening. So that's the first thing, pretending and provision. And then secondly, pretending and protection. Verses 10 to 15. Now, I'm sure that we've all done things in our lives where we've looked back at afterwards and thought, whatever was I thinking? Whatever did I do that for? I'm sure that some of us have more of those occasions than we'd like to admit, don't we? Probably. Decisions we made in the moment that we can hardly believe that we did it. What were we thinking? Perhaps we made them without thinking or in a moment of panic and they turned out to be not the best decisions we've ever made. Well, surely David makes one of those decisions here, doesn't he? We read in verse 10, David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. The expression out of the frying pan into the fire springs to mind. We go Gath, that name sounds familiar, doesn't it? Gath. We've heard that name before in 1 Samuel, haven't we? Connected with Goliath of Gath. Goliath of Gath. So David flees from Saul and strolls right into the hometown of Goliath, whose head he'd cut off. And what's he got in his hand? Goliath's sword. Perhaps the blacksmith of Gath recognized it. We don't know, do we? Surely that tells us how much he feared Saul. How desperate he was. I mean, it tells us that, surely. He's ready to go to such a place to escape him. I suppose he's thinking, well, if there's one place that Saul's not going to go, it's going to be the head of the Philistine territory, to Gath. I mean, he's not going to follow me there. But it was just as dangerous for David, wasn't it? I mean, what was David thinking? Perhaps he was thinking, well, they might not know me. They may not remember me. They may not recognize me. I might be able to blend in somehow. Well, that certainly doesn't turn out to be the case. David turns out to be very well known. And look at verse 11. Indeed, the people of Gath even knew the song the Israelite women sang about him. Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. I suppose if you came from Gath and you heard that song, it would tend to stick, wouldn't it? Because those 10,000s came mainly from Gath and the surrounding area. So we think, what was David thinking? Perhaps he was thinking the king of King Achish would be glad to have a sort of a defection from Saul, his top man, defected to the Philistines. Well, it soon becomes clear that that is not how it's going to be seen. So, in fact, if you turn now to Psalm, so there's a couple of Psalms that are on this passage. So, let's turn to Psalm 56. So, the introductions to the Psalms are always helpful. Some of them have more of an introduction, tell you something about the backgrounds. And so Psalm 56, look, begins a mission of David when the Philistines captured him in Gath, okay? So they've captured him. He's turned up there and they've captured him. They've arrested him. That's the situation. Now, back in our passage in verse 12, it's almost amusing, isn't it, when it tells us that when the song about David was recited in the presence of the king, David took these words to heart. I mean, he realized this is a serious situation that I'm in now. He's a captive of the king of the country whose men he's killed by the thousand. It's no wonder the verse back in our passage, verse 12, tells us he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. And so what does he do? What does he do? Well, he changes his behavior, we're told, and pretended to be mad. So he begins to scribble and scratch on the door of the place and dribble into his beard. So if you want to know whether you're mad or not, there's one way. Do you dribble into your beard or not? I mean, there's a measure of desperation, isn't there? There's a measure of panic. He has to do something. He has to do something quick. And so he feigns madness. And he clearly, give him credit. He obviously does a pretty convincing job, doesn't he? I mean, it's an award-winning performance. He's up for an Oscar, isn't he? I mean, the king is not very impressed with his men for bringing this madman into his place, is he? The whole scene's a bit of an embarrassment. But look at verse 14. Achish says, look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen? You brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this mad fellow come into my house? They clearly he didn't feel David's in any state to be a threat or anything. And he just, it's, again, the beginning of Psalm 34 tells us that they drove him away. The introduction to Psalm 34, Psalm of David, when he pretended madness before Abimelech. Now, don't get too worried about Abimelech. That's like the dynastic name, like Pharaoh. So it's Achish the king, but he's also would be known as Abimelech. It's a similar name to a Pharaoh. Who drove him away, okay, and he departed. So they go, oh, man, let's get rid of him. Drive him out of the place. Throw him out of the place. Get rid of him. And so they drive him out, and he wanders off, and he escapes. Now, if you're in Psalm 34, stay in Psalm 34, because we can't help but notice that David saw this as more than just good luck or just more than down to his acting skills. He saw this as deliverance from the Lord, as protection from the Lord. It's not a matter of coincidence that the people of Gath don't tear him to pieces. I mean, that would be what you would expect. He's killed thousands of their people. And they just drive him away. David is protected here. Look what he says, Psalm 34, verse 7. The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him. And delivers them. Here's the reason why David walks out of Gath unharmed. Not because he's got amazing acting skills, ultimately, but because the angel of the Lord is encamped around him and he's protecting him. He's the Lord's anointed. The Lord's going to keep him and watch over him. He's known protection from the Lord. In fact, both of those psalms, Psalm 34 and Psalm 56, make clear that in the midst of all of this, even though he's desperate and he's pretending, he is at the same time crying out to the Lord. He's trusting in the Lord. So he's, verse 4 of Psalm 34, I sought the Lord and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. He speaks it in that way, doesn't he? Or Psalm, if you just turn on to Psalm 56, it's got those words, when I'm afraid, verse 3, when I'm afraid, I will trust in you, in God, I will praise his word, in God I put my trust, I will not fear. So he's at the beginning, he's afraid, verse 3, whenever I'm afraid, but what am I going to do? I'm going to trust in you. So we see this scene, and it seems all chaotic, and it seems like David, what is David doing? But in the midst of it, he's trusting God, he's crying out to the Lord, he's putting his trust in the Lord, and the Lord is watching over him. If you're in Psalm 56, if you're not there, turn there, because there's some wonderful words in Psalm 56. Verses 8 and 9, look. You number my wanderings, put my tears into your bottle. Are they not in your book? When I cry out to you, then my enemies will turn back. This I know, because God is for me. You see that? God is for me. That's a wonderful picture, isn't it? You number my wanderings, put my tears into your bottle. Are they not in your book? So nothing is missed, in other words, okay? Not one step, not one tear, all known. So, brothers and sisters, I wonder how many tears have been wept in this room. In sorrows, in trials, in heartache, when your life has fallen apart, when things have happened to you and to your family, to your relationships, when you have loved ones who don't know the Lord, or you've gone through physical illness or spiritual illness or mental illness and you've wept, when how many tears have been shed in this room? Well, we don't know, but somebody knows. Somebody's numbered them all. The Lord. You haven't wept a single tear that the Lord hasn't known. Hasn't, in that sense, put in a bottle. So that they're there before him. And why is that? Well, did you notice that? Look at the end of verse 9. This I know because God is... Somebody say it for me. God is for me. That remind you of anything? The greatest chapter in the Bible, in my view. We can argue about it. Romans chapter 8. If God be for us, who can be against us? And that doesn't mean we don't have enemies. It means, who does it matter who's against us? God being for us doesn't mean no trials or troubles come. I mean, you've only got to look at the life of David to see that. But it does mean that the Lord will be with us in them all and bring us ultimately through them all. And it means that nothing, as Romans 8 goes on, can separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. So brother or sister here tonight, you trusting in Jesus Christ? You know this, don't you? God is for you in your troubles, in your trials, as the tears fall. Your God is for you. He's on your side. Protecting you, keeping you, watching over you. There's a thing to remember and be encouraged by tonight. Pretending and protection. Third thing, the last two are shorter. People and parents. People and parents. Now we're in chapter 22, verses 1 to 5. David leaves Gath and he leaves Philistine territory and comes to the cave of Adullam. The town of Adullam was about 16 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Adullam means refuge. And it was certainly a place of refuge for David. And not just for David. It became a place of refuge for others as well. So look, verse 1 tells us his brother and all his father's house came down and joined them. It's obviously not going to be safe for them while Saul is still on the throne. So they come down there. But then verse 2, we have this wonderful picture of all sorts of other people who joined David. Everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented, gathered to him. Anyone who's in trouble, anyone who's got a complaint against Saul, just about any misfit found their way to the cave of Adullam. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it, of a whole hodgepodge of people. Not the sort of people you might want to gather to you. You're thinking, let's get an army together. Who should we get? Well, let's get everyone who's in debt, and let's get everyone who's discontented and likes to moan. Let's get all them together. That'll be good. No. But God in his providence brings all those people together, doesn't he? To David's. And they would form a... don't we get a little picture of great David's greater son, the Lord Jesus Christ? We see him, the disciples. I mean, well, they're a hodgepodge, aren't they? And yet the Lord is going to use them, isn't he? And that's just the way God works. I mean, in a sense, we've already seen it. There's mighty Goliath, and who goes out? Little David goes out to fight him. Mark took us to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, didn't he? A couple of weeks ago. Not many mighty, not many noble. Pretty unimpressive people. And that's the way God loves to work, isn't it? He's not like, you know, one of those rich football club owners. You know, a club gets a rich owner suddenly and buys all the best players from all around the world and buys success, and everyone hates it, don't they? God goes and gets the free transfer people, doesn't he? And nobody else wants on their team. And he brings them together, doesn't he? So that he'll have all the glory and all the praise. Some churches have named their places of worship, the Cave of Adullam. You know, in a sense, every church is a Cave of Adullam, isn't it? I hope you're not offended by that. That's the way God works. He likes to bring a hodgepodge of people together, funny old people, and saves and uses them so that he'll have all the glory. And then in verses 3 to 5, we have the problem of parents to deal with. So David's parents, Jesse and his wife, turn up at the cave, and it's clear to David, I think, that they're not in a fit state to cope with the sort of life that following David around is going to involve. And so David takes them to Mizpah, doesn't he, in Moab, to the king of Moab, and asks if they can stay there until David knows what, end of verse 3, what God will do for me. David stays there a while himself in the stronghold until the prophet Gad comes with a message for the Lord telling him to go to Judah, and he goes to dwell in the forest of Herath. Now we might ask, how is it that David could go to Moab and be there and leave his parents safely there and that be acceptable to the king of Moab? And why would that be the case, do you think? Well, though the text doesn't state it, surely because he's got some Moabite blood in him, hasn't he, David? Yeah. Indeed, Jesse, the son of Obed, the son of Boaz, is quarter Moabite, isn't he? His grandma Ruth was a Moabitess. That would surely have endeared the family to the king of Moab. We're reminded, I think, aren't we, just another way in which God is in control of all things and has everything in his plan and purpose. Now, it was right for David, wasn't it, even in the midst of his trouble, to look after and sort out the needs of his parents. Some of you have had to do that. Some of you are having to do that now. You weren't the first, and you won't be the last. It's right, isn't it, that we look out for, as best we can, our parents. So, last thing. Not the nicest thing to end with, but here it is. Chapter 22, verse 6 to 23. Saul and slaughter. So Saul is staying under the tamarisk trees in Gibeah, in Ramah. And he's stewing, isn't he? He is stewing further and further over David, feeling sorry for himself, feeling threatened, feeling his people have been keeping things from him. Friends, if we ever wanted a picture of where bitterness and harboring jealousy and envy can take you, well, here's a warning. for us all. He says in verse 7 and 8, let me just read those words again. Hear now, you Benjamites, this is what he said. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me. There's no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. There's no one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. And he's just feeling sorry for himself, and he's full of envy and imagining the worst from David, who isn't lying in wait for him at all. He's on the run from him. And then we notice, don't we, verse 9, Doeg the Edomite is there listening to Saul. We should have noticed him in the previous chapter, shouldn't we? He's hanging around the tabernacle for some reason, chapter 21, verse 7. And that verse proves to be fatal for Ahimelech and the rest of the priests, because Doeg decides it's time to tell Saul something. And so he tells Saul about the son of Jesse in verses 8 and 9, sorry, 9 and 10, doesn't he? About how David had gone there and Ahimelech had given him bread and a sword, and he inquired of the Lord for him, although that bit seems to be made up, doesn't it? Add to the story. And that's all Saul needs to hear, isn't it? He summons Ahimelech, we read it, didn't we, and all his house, and all the priests are summoned to Saul. And they all come clearly unaware there's any problem. And the king doesn't wait to hear Ahimelech's side of the story. He accuses him straight away. And then without realizing it, Ahimelech speaks highly of David, doesn't he? Condemning Saul still further. Verse 14, and who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? I mean, that's the truth about David. But Saul has had enough, hasn't he? Someone's going to die. And it's going to be Ahimelech and his family. Saul is further shamed, isn't he? Because his own servants won't do it. They won't do it. They know when something's wrong. But Doeg, the Edomite, does it. And they're killed. And all the people of Nov as well are killed. So slaughtering your own people isn't simply something that 20th century leaders do. It's happened many times down through history when people have been desperate to hold on to power and become suspicious and paranoid. Everyone is a threat. That's the wickedness of the human heart, isn't it? What depths can be found there? We turn on the news and hear the things we do. We shouldn't be surprised, should we? That's what the human heart is like. Well, the chapter ends with one man escaping. Abiathar escapes, son of Ahimelech, the high priest. He escapes and he goes to David, and he tells David everything, and David says, he knew that Doeg would tell Saul, and he feels it's all on him. And so he says to Abiathar, doesn't he, stay with me, I'll look after you, you'll be safe. So we've got this great contrast here, haven't we? We've got David on the run and Saul in the palace, as it were. But who would you rather be? Saul's on his own now, isn't he? He's got no prophet. Samuel won't go to him anymore. He's got no priests. But David over here, he's got the Lord. He's got the Lord's servants with him. I mean, who would you rather be? Where would you rather be? Have the Lord and his words and his priests and the sacrifice? I mean, that's where to be, isn't it? Trusting in the Lord, resting in his grace, having the Lord on your side.